Nancy, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Nancy.
I know our speaker from Biscayne down in Atlanta. We both go to many meetings there. And I will admit, I don't know Alex all that well. But our paths have crossed many times over many years. And the word that jumps out at me to describe Alex, are you ready for this? is consistency. He shows up, he shares at meetings, and he's always ready to be of service to others. He also has a pretty good sense of humor, but I got a feeling under that sense of humor there's going to be a story that we all relate to. So with that, I give you Alex. Yay!
My name's Alex. I'm an alcoholic. Thank y'all for having me up here tonight. I don't think I've actually ever been to a meeting here in the years that I've been in the program. So it's great to be up here and see some familiar faces. And I appreciate y'all coming out on Saturday night. My wife, who's also in the program, was going to come, but then she said, well, the Bulldogs are on television tonight, so sorry, I'm going to stay home. She goes, plus I know your story pretty well, so I lost out to the Bulldogs. But I was told when I came in that when you tell your story, you're supposed to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it was like, what it's like now. I was born in Atlanta in 1959, grew up in Doraville, Georgia, although my family, and I'm an only child, we moved a few times, but I basically grew up here in Atlanta. And, of course, at that time, this area was, you know, way out in the country, and Doraville was actually on the edge of the city. So Atlanta certainly changed pretty dramatically. I don't have any, you know, riveting tale of being a wild biker and, you know, gunning down people or robbing banks or going to prison and getting out or anything like that. I was just kind of a garden variety, middle-class American alcoholic teenager. And, of course, growing up in the 70s, other substances as well. The first thing I can remember about alcohol is I come from kind of a long line of alcoholics and depressives, and, you know, I come by it pretty naturally. My father, and it's interesting, I recently told my story. When I got here at 20, my idea of my father was I was very bitter. And, you know, Dad, why did you treat me so wrong and all that stuff? And, you know, my inner child's hurt and all that. But now that I'm 56 and I have, you know, a 35-year-old son and a 30-year-old daughter and five grandsons, and my father's still living, my opinion or my feeling towards my father has changed dramatically. He's 83 and he's in a rehab facility because he's just had knee replacement, got an infection. But I, you know, I coach football, I own a business, and then I coach football at a high school. And every Wednesday after I finish practice, it's in Norcross, I go up and see my dad. And, you know, was my dad a great dad? Not really. But did he love me? Yes. Did he put food on the table? Yes. Did he go to work every morning? Yes. Did he do the best he could with what he had? Yes. And, you know, it's nice because the program has restored that relationship. Now, my father drank alcoholically and moderated. How he's done that, I don't really know. But he did. That's not my story, but that's his. But our relationship is completely different. And so it's the program, it's profound in how it's, you know, as you stay sober for years, my notion of the world around me has changed dramatically, and I attribute that to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was introduced to alcohol by my father back then. If you had a cold or you had to, you needed something for an ailment, they just put some Jack Daniels in a shot glass, heated it, put in some brown sugar, squeezed some lemon, said, drink this, bam, let's go, you're okay. And I guess that was our version of NyQuil today. So one of my earliest memories of alcohol was, hey, being an only child, we got to go on the road and got to go give him a shot of whiskey, put him in the car, let's go. We got to get, we're going Christmas or something. I don't remember, but that's my earliest memory of alcohol. Did I like it? I mean, I don't know. I think I was out. When you grow up an only child, it's almost like you're a third adult. And my dad was in business, so I was raised as almost a third adult. So I actually learned how to bet a point spread before I learned how to ride a bike. I learned how to play poker before I learned how to ride a bike. And frankly, I was quite fascinated with his lifestyle. We traveled, and back then, they called them stewardesses and instead of flight attendants, and they were all very beautiful. And we went to restaurants, and again, that was America of the 60s. You could pinch the waitress and do all these things. And I watched my father and his buddies. I was like, this looks fun. I mean, who wants to... my wife will constantly say, didn't you hear that nursery? Don't you know these children's stories? I said, no, but I can tell you I lost $5 in Sunday school in the 1968 Super Bowl when the Jets were favored by 17 or were 17-point underdogs and the Joe Namath, they won and things like that. So that was what was fascinating to me. I wanted to get old, and I wanted to get old quickly. And, and I did. As soon the first time I drank alcohol, I guess I was, other than my dad saying, here, have a sip of beer or whatever, like he would do, was when I was 14. And when I drank alcohol that time, it was like, wow, literally, it was like finding God. And of course, drugs was the same thing. And being an alcoholic, I remember the first time I smoked pot, it kind of made me feel wheezy, but, I got to try it again. It was the same thing with cigarettes. I'm going to smoke this until I get it right. I mean, it's got to be good. Look at all these people. And, same thing with booze. So I threw up. So what? I mean, they seem to enjoy it. I want to, get in there. And so I jumped right in. Prior to drinking, I was kind of the model kid. I was a patrol, and I played sports and did very well in school and student council and all that stuff. But, once I started drinking, forget about it. And all that stuff just kind of went by the wayside. Like I said, I started at 14. And my dad, again, we had an interesting relationship. Most parents, when they catch their kids drinking, they, you get the lecture and... you get grounded. He just said, God dang it, buy your own booze. Stay out of mine. And so that was, his response. And what ended up happening is my poor mother, they've been married 62 years. She's never really drank and, sings in the church choir and all that. She's living with two drunks. And to say that my dad and I butted heads would be an understatement. I was very rebellious, anti-authoritarian. If you told me, I remember all the lectures the counselors would get you at school and, they'd say, why are you, you were such a smart boy and now you're, what's happened? And I'm like, you think about it, how stupid can you be? I used to drink Jack Daniels before school. Wouldn't the teacher smell it? I mean, when they're sitting there and you smell like we smoked weed every morning before school, and you think, wouldn't the counselor, they're sitting there asking you, what's wrong? I mean, they had to smell it instead of, what's changed about, get off of my back. What's changed, baby, is I'm sleeping late and smoking tea and living out my fantasy, Leave me alone, buddy. I mean, this is a good life. So, I enjoyed it in high school. It actually, you know, up to a point. But what happens inevitably, and the book talks about that. I mean, it's fun for a time. I mean, I saw Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones and Aerosmith and Skinner, and, you know, the 70s was fun. I mean, the 60s had kind of blown open American society. In the 70s, you could do anything. I mean, I remember getting pulled over for, you know, being drunk, and the cops would stop you and say, well, you know, they kind of knew all the kids. Have you been drinking? Yeah, I've been drinking. Well, do you promise you'll drive home? Yes, sir, I'll drive straight home. And the cops would just let you go. And so it was kind of a free-for-all. And because we hadn't really had that tidal wave of what alcohol and drug addiction wrought with especially our generation. So, I mean, I had a pretty good time, but with my so-called good time, one of my first incidences where things really went haywire is I got busted at a basketball game when I was 15. And, you know, prior to that, I was involved in athletics. And, you know, this is kind of a moment that I look back on with tremendous regret, because at that time it was basketball season, and my friend and I drank a bunch of Mad Dog 2020 and downed a bunch of barbiturates and decided to go to a varsity basketball game and, you know, fell down the steps and we got arrested. I mean, it was an ugly situation. And I ended up getting arrested out in front of God and everybody in front of the gym and, you know, during the game. And I was very obnoxious with the cops. And, I mean, it was an ugly scene. And my friend ratted me out, of course, said I had done everything. You know, when you're drinking your buddies, the notion of a good friend, I mean, forget about it. I mean, this guy turned the table on me so fast. He did everything. He smashed all the antennas and, you know, and the cops, they went after me. And my the cops told my mom, if you're, because I was very abusive and obnoxious, and my mother came in and they told her, if you weren't such a nice lady, we were going to send your son to Alto for about a month, which Alto used to be the juvenile facility. I don't know if it still is, but, you know, but that was a pit. What is it?
It's a ladies' prison.
Oh, really? Well, I wouldn't have minded that either, you know. Orange is the new black, right? But anyhow, you know, that was, I mean, I look back on that now, and it's interesting. Back then, you know, adults, they didn't try to say, well, let's rehabilitate him. I just remember the athletic director getting me in his office and said, you know what, you're poison. We don't want you involved in athletics. You're out of everything. And you're off the team, and you are. You're poison. You're a bad kid. And so I said, you know what? You're right. I am. And so I proceeded to pursue that bad boy thing because, you know, water seeks its own level. And I think about that now because I coach kids. And, you know, one of the promises, you know, we won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I mean, I regretted that for many years. But what's happened in my coaching is, you know, God has used that for me to be able to help kids instead of, hey, saying you're a bad kid, actually was able to help a kid that I coached who I brought to meetings and he was thrown out of school, but we got him back in school and then he kept playing football and was able to play in college. So, you know, God used that many years later. But that was a pivotal incident in my life. And after that, I just, you know, proceeded. And I'm not going to bore you with all these stories, you know, fighting. I do know one thing, though. I did try to quit when I was 18. I made a sincere effort because we went on our senior trip and I got busted for fighting and they shipped me home and, you know, got thrown off in the Bahamas, another red letter day in the Livingston household. And, you know, aren't you proud of your son, you know? But anyhow, I came back to Atlanta after getting, you know, in this brawl and unceremoniously booted off the SS Flavia in Freeport and said, I'm going to quit. I'm going to quit everything. And I lasted a week. And that was the longest week in my life. I remember one of my buddies coming to the door, and it was almost like, yes, yes, please, let's have a drink and whatever else. So I continued down that path. And I will say, just to show you the insanity of alcoholism, and again, I took drugs, but I took drugs so I could drink. I mean, I would take speed so I could go to Green's Disco on Tuesday night on Peachtree Industrial when it was a quarter of schnapps and penny a beer. And I'd love to take speed because that meant I'd be able to down about 30 or 40 beers and not feel it, of course, until the next morning when it feels like, you know, somebody's taking a plunger to your insides. But I hid a bottle of Golden Grain in the attic because if I couldn't find any, you know, other substances, I would go up there and hit that. And, you know, 180 proof does a marvelous job for kind of giving you a jolt. And so, in fact, you can actually set it on fire. I mean, have you ever thought of the insanity of that? That it, you actually are drinking something that's flammable? I mean, you know, I mean, think about that. Because the last time I quit, what was happening was a lot of my friends, one of my friends, his mom kind of went on this crazed, the teenage drug addict and alcoholic. She became like on the governor's committee of, you know, alcoholism and all this. So she gets this notion that we got to save all these unrepentant alcoholic teenagers like myself and her son, who is my best friend. And he ends up, I remember the first meeting I went to was at Peachford. And Peachford, they used to have an alcohol and drug unit for teenagers. And so he drugged me. He said, listen, we got to go to this meeting to get my mom off my back. And when we go over there, then we'll go to Green's. And so I had a bunch of, you know, white powder in my pocket. And I said, okay, let's go. I said, but this is Nazi BS. I mean, you're being brainwashed, okay? So we go in there, and all I remember about that meeting is there was this girl on the other side of the room who just immediately caught my eye. And I said, look at her. That's because she looked like this girl that we thought was so hot and whatever. And he goes, listen, you can't do that. And I tried to get her attention. I said, let's get her out of here and take her with us. He's like, no, no, no. And so we took off. And I remember the girl looked at me like, you're trash, you know, because she was a patient. So we left. But the girl comes back into play a few months later. But anyhow, what happened was is my friend, they eventually put him in Peachford. And this is how, you know, it's funny. It sounds funny, but it's not. I mean, he was in Peachford and I snuck him out of there and we went to the liquor store and got a bottle of Jack Daniels and I gave it to him and he took it back into Peachford where there's all these people trying to recover. Well, he, of course, he's one of the few people to, I think, ever be thrown out of a rehab center. Even they said, we don't even want your insurance, okay? They threw him out for, you know, taking this bottle and giving it to everybody on the unit. And, you know, I thought that was so funny because he came, you know, we're 19. And he says, yeah, I gave it to this one old guy and he gets it and he's just doing like that. And we just howled with laughter. And I think about that now. We might have killed that man. You know, there's nothing funny about that. He snuck that bottle of whiskey onto the unit. And, you know, we could be responsible for somebody's death. But to us, that was great. I mean, that was hilarious because, you know, we were doing our thing. And, you know, all this stuff about getting sober and all that, forget about it. Well, what ends up happening is we continue down our descent of addiction and drunkenness and I'm flunking out of my, you know, fourth college, I think. I was doing the Tommy Boy, you know, track, which I guess some of you, have y'all seen that, the movie? Where he says, you know, seven, or no, for us older kids, it's Blutarski from Animal House, remember? Mr. Blutarski, you have a 0.0 GPA, so that's about what I have. But anyhow, what happened is my buddy, he actually disappeared. And I heard he had gotten sober. And so I continued on my way down into my descent. And the last time, this is before the first time I came in the program. And again, this shows you the total insanity of addiction and alcoholism. I started my last day by drinking moonshine. And again, we lit it in the ashtray because if it burns blue, it's clean. If it's green, it's got wood poison. So I started the day out like that. And I ended up with a needle in my arm that night. And to show you the insanity of it, I had never shot up. But I knew I was going to go home that night and ask my parents to help me get sober. So I wanted to shoot up one time before I got straight. Now, God was with me because I did it once in this dingy, crummy, dirty bathroom. And of course, it was, you know, it's like the hallelujah chorus. But what happened was, is I tried to do it again, and my heart was just pounding like this. And I'm convinced if I would have done it again, my buddy was trying to shoot me up, and his hand was shaking so hard he couldn't hit me. If he'd have hit me again, I think I might have died. I really do, because I wasn't used to that type thing. But again, that shows you where booze will take you. To some stinking, miserable bathroom in somebody's apartment of somebody I don't even know, with somebody's hand shaking to try to hit you. And that's after, you know, I've been drinking all day. So what a great life. Well, anyhow, I walked into my parents' house that night, and I said, I need help. After, you know, that I'd come down, and my parents were unsure about, well, if you go to these meetings, won't people be drinking there and all that? But again, you know, so I went to my first meeting, and I called my friend, and I said, his name's Ken, and I said, Ken, I need help. And so he said, I've been waiting on you to call. And he had 3 months at that time. Now, I will tell you, I want to make sure I make this point, because for everyone in here, my friend Ken, you know, I've been sober now almost 35 years, but my friend Ken had over 20 years, and, you know, we came in with nothing. Well, he went out and made a bunch of money, had all these Lexuses and condo and a business, and he's in Mexico right now. Because he had to run from the cops because he got popped selling weed over at the University of Alabama. Because what happened was, when he had 20 years of sobriety, he's making all this money, and he was in China. And, you know, he was visiting one of his suppliers for doors, not for other things. But they said, well, you know, he said, when you're in China, you have to drink with them, you know. And so I was like, well, you didn't eat like the cats or whatever, did you? I mean, but he made the point, like, I couldn't insult my guest because, you know, so I had to drink. And to see that, I mean, here, that's where it started. And now he's no longer in the program. He had to escape the feds. He got busted for dealing weed to an 18-year-old freshman at Alabama. And so that, you know, that's what happens. It never ends. You know where he is right now? He is back smoking weed with Led Zeppelin cranked to the 50th decibel level, living in some hovel on the coast of Mexico. And guess he's back where we started or where we came in. And alcohol is a subtle foe, alcoholism. It never stops haunting you. And I've seen that. That's why I still go to meetings. That's why I still work with people. I'm as capable today of walking out there and getting in my car and going down to the liquor store or to the local whatever dealer and being right back where I was like that if I forget that I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I know that. And I've seen the insanity of this disease. And in fact, the three people who helped me get sober, all three of them, and these are people that had over 20 years of sobriety. I'm not talking about people with 2 months. I'm talking about people with years, are all out because they stopped. They forgot ground zero that I'm an alcoholic and cannot ever drink again successfully one day at a time. So anyhow, he did take me to my first meeting. Now, the first meeting I went to, I said, where's that girl? Is she going to be there? And he said, listen, you can't meet that girl. When you come to meetings, you have to be just focused on sobriety. And I'm like, yeah, okay, we'll do that. So we went to this meeting over at NAB, and it was a young people's meeting, and there was that girl. Now, that girl is watching the Georgia game right now, and I've been married to her, you know, for 36 years. But anyhow, I don't know that I recommend doing that because I met her at my first AA meeting. Now she was she had a long term sobriety. She had 7 months, but the first step I worked was number 13, I guess. But I know it sounds crazy, but it was love at first sight. I mean, when I saw her. And we started going out 5 days later, and I would go home and pray, God, this is the one. This is the one. And so, I came into AA, and back then there was kind of the first wave of young people. It was 1980, and there was a big crowd of people who were, my age. And I knew I was a drunk. I mean, I'd been a drunk since the first time I ever picked up booze. But it was so wonderful because you walk in and you realize, wow, there are people my age who are sober. And like I said, I had tried to stay sober that 1 week and couldn't make it. And I still, to this day, will say that my 1 month chip is the chip I remember the most. The 1 month the first time. I picked it up at Peachford on a Saturday night, and it was just so profound to me that I had actually stayed sober for a month. I mean, I couldn't wrap my mind around that. And what's interesting, if you have a month or two in here, you have a lot to share. When I came in and somebody said they had 35 years, I'm like, come on, man. You got to be lying. Nobody has 35 years of sobriety. I'm not even 35. But when somebody said they had a month, you had my attention. Because I could not stay sober. From the time I started at 14, I could not. I spent every day pursuing alcohol and drugs. So again, if you're just here and you're new, you have a powerful story to share. Again, especially with somebody like me when I came in, because I just couldn't fathom that. And it's interesting, I remember when I first picked up the big book, when I read Bill's story, it was like, wow, there is a solution. Because here I was 20 and I thought, my God, this is going how I'm going to live the rest of my life. I'm never going to get sober. I don't even know how to. I don't even know how to go a day without either going, daytimer planned, Tuesday night greens, Wednesday night Flanagan's, Sunday night $5 down at Kelly's on Peachtree, all you can drink for $5. Of course, Friday and Saturday, it's just, wherever. I mean, that's the weekend. Of course, Thursday is a warm-up. Monday, you find somewhere to go. And, you're a drunk when you call someone to say, hey, let's go get hammered tonight. It's Monday, so... I mean, what does that have anything to do? But anyhow, so I come in the program and I meet my wife, my future wife. And, I think I stayed sober that first 6 months on love. But love produced an offspring. And so after being dating about 6 months, she called me and said, I'm pregnant. And it's not the Immaculate Conception, buddy. So here I am. I'm 20, and she's 18. And, it's interesting because I remember telling my dad, he said, boy, he said, you got to become a man. He said, you've been running your whole life. It's time for you to do the right thing. And we wanted to. I mean, we wanted to get married. But he said, it's time for you to, get married. Do the right thing. You've been running your whole life. What are you going to do? Go hide under the covers and disappear? And so we got married. Well, marriage brings it makes the relationship different, should we say. The pink cloud was over. I remember fighting on our honeymoon down at the Driftwood Inn in Fort Walton because she told me I was going to quit smoking because she was pregnant. I said, you quitting? I ain't quitting smoking. You're the one with the baby, not me. Immediately we were fighting. So it was like Ollie Frazier for, the first 10 years. But anyhow, of course, I did what every drunk does when faced with reality and hasn't really worked the program. I got drunk. Here was, I was been married a month. I got hammered. Now, fortunately, my wife, she never picked up. She's been sober since she was 17. She's a one chip, you know, picked up one white chip. She's got 37 years, because she July of 79. But she didn't pick up, but I did. And what happened is, you know, you never know if you pick up if you're ever going to make it back. Now, fortunately, I did. But I picked up enough white chips to fill up that container at the Biscayne room. And it just, you know, I wouldn't admit. And what happened was my last drunk, my son had been born, and he was, I guess he was almost a year. And I remember the last drink I had, I ended up in the old Limelight parking lot at Buckhead Tavern. And, you know, I came home and threw up. And I ended up at the foot of my son's crib with my pants around my ankles. And I remember my son the next morning was looking over at me. And it hit me that your son is going to grow up with the same kind of father you did if you don't get sober. And that was the last time I ever drank. And I, you know, this right here is kind of my favorite, or kind of the saying from the big book that I hold on to. It says, this is from More About Alcoholism, "We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed." Smashed. That's right. Smashed. Right? I mean, and it was. It was smashed that night, February 5th, 1982. I was 22. And what's cool is my third grandson's, he was born on February 5th, 2013. So, you know, that's wonderful to think that I have a grandson that was born on my sobriety date, because I would have never seen him. Never. And it's interesting. I started, you know, Judy was up here last night from Biscayne, and I came in NA, and I love NA, but NA didn't have any time at that point in history. So I started going to Biscayne with these, I don't want to say older people, because I'm 56 now. It's funny, you know, you came to visit the Tuesday night young people's meeting. Ain't nobody young anymore. We had these people from IKIPA or whatever in there one night to raise money for the International Young People, and I was leading the discussion, and you could tell they were looking at us funny. I said, "You thought this was a young people's meeting, didn't you?" They're like, I said, "Well, we all got old." And so we've changed the name to "We've Had Enough," and we've dropped the young people's. But anyhow, you know, what happened is I met these people in AA, and my first sponsor, he drug me back in the back room of Biscayne, and he said, "Son, if you don't stop drinking and work these steps, you're going to be dead before you're 25. That's the facts." And I listened. It was Judy's husband. I don't know if y'all were here last week, but it was her husband who passed away in 2000. He was my first sponsor. But he told me the truth. And that man taught me how to not only stay sober, he taught me how to be a man. He was really somewhat of a father to me. He taught me how to work. I worked for him for a while. And I remember Claudia and I, my wife, would get to fighting. I remember fighting one morning, and of course I called him, "Oh, we've been fighting." And, you know, I was looking for that mental health day. I was working at a cemetery while I was going to college, and he was the landscape foreman at this cemetery down at 20 and 285. And I was looking for him to say, "Oh, I know y'all were fighting. It's okay. You better go to a meeting." He said, "Your ass better be here at 7 o'clock. And he hung up on me. And he said, "We'll talk about it afterward." So little stuff like that. He said, "You know, you have to get, you know," because I'd never worked. I couldn't even keep a job. I mean, I'd worked. But, you know, when you're drinking, if you want to take a day off, you just take it. I remember one night I worked the night shift at this bakery. I remember in the 79 Pittsburgh Pirates were in town, and I was driving by the stadium thinking, freaking Willie Stargell, Bill Madlock, Dave Parker, freaking Doc Ellis, the LSD dropping, no hit throwing pitcher. I'm going to see the Pirates. And I pulled in there and just didn't go to work. And, you know, Next night, boss, where were you? Oh, I was at the Pirates, man. We're in town. He got pissed. He said, why didn't you call me? I'd have met you over there. But anyhow, you know, I mean, you just do that. So I had to learn how to work and actually go to school. And the people in the Biscayne room taught me how to work. And what was good then is we had a three-day recovery. You can't do that anymore because all the lawyers and insurance and all that crap. But we would actually bring people in there. And you'd give them this yeast concoction, and they would sleep in the back. And what happened is if the phone rang, like here at the Howl Club, as you picked it up and said, hello, this is Biscayne, may I help you? And they said, well, I need somebody to come. If you went and got them on a 12-step call, you were responsible for them. You had to stay with them for 3 days. And I saw some things that made me realize where I was heading. I remember holding an old guy, had to hold him just so he could use the bathroom. And he's shaking like this with the DTs. And it's like, that's the ghost of Christmas future, buddy. That's where you're going. And so it had a profound impact on me. Plus, you know, instead of sitting around navel-gazing and, oh, you know, well, I wish my dad hadn't treated my... I mean, you don't have time to do that because you're busy helping another person. Those are the facts. I mean, there is nothing better then if you're going through this like us, you know, which I do still today, woe is me, the best thing to do is work with another drunk. Just go to a freaking meeting, find out a guy who picks up a white chip or somebody that looks like they're struggling, walk up, introduce yourself, and start talking to him. And all of a sudden, my problems are not very significant. I mean, I coached football, and last Saturday, one of our players almost died on the field. I mean, I went to see him this morning. He's 13 years old, and we barely got him to grade. He had a head injury. When you go see a 13-year-old kid in a hospital and doesn't know if he's ever going to walk again or talk again, he's going to looking at 12 months in front of him at Scottish Rite, my problems ain't that big. It's the same thing with booze, you know, with working with other alcoholics. This notion that we should sit around and navel gaze and, you know, what does it matter what happened to me? It did. Deal with it. And that's what these people at Biscayne told me. I can remember sitting in there in a meeting, moaning and groaning, and some old timer look over his glasses at me. What are you going to do about it? I was like, huh? He just said, shut up, man. What are you going to do about it? I'm sick of listening to your whining. And you'd be like, wow. I mean, nobody's ever spoke. But see, these people could speak to me like that because I knew they had my best interest. You know, and that old man told me, he said, you know what? Your sobriety is more important than your friendship with me. I'm going to tell you what you need to hear. I don't care if you like me or not. And I thank God for people who were willing to freaking give me the truth because that's what I needed. I mean, I was one of these kids that if you came up to me and, like I was telling about my counselor, let's help Alex, I would eat you alive. But somebody who talked to me like that, you had my attention, especially the fact that you'd been where I'd been. I mean, that's why one alcoholic helping another alcoholic, you can immediately have that person's attention within minutes. Well, anyhow, you know, I did the old... And I've been sober 35 years. Hell, I could sit up here and talk till 11, but I'll make a couple of points. The first thing I did is I got in, got sober, you know, went back to college, got a great job, started making a lot of money, had kids, living the middle class life. And, I was young. I don't need the program anymore. You know, these people, they're drunks, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm making money, you know. The lady who stood here last week, she would tell you straight, I think it was my 8th birthday, and I hadn't been to a meeting in a few months and got up there and said a bunch of crap about how well I was doing. She came up to me and my wife, who was with me. She said, you know what? It is the freaking height of arrogance and ingratitude to come in this program and take and get your life back together and then leave. Who's going to be here for the people coming in the door? And that was like, you know, pow, cold water in the face. But things were not as good as they seem. You don't go to meetings for a while, and it's a damn hard thing to swallow when you're living the life of a drunk, but you're not drinking. You know, when you have to look at the mirror and you say, wow, my behavior is the same as it was when I was drinking, but I don't have booze to blame it on anymore. And so my wife and I had a a meltdown at about 10 years of, you know, a lot of it was to my behavior. And, you know, my behavior was wrong. I was, I'm not going to go into detail, but I was traveling. I was on the road. I had a lot of money. You fill in the blanks. I was 30, and I almost destroyed my marriage with other behavior, should we say. And here I am with two kids. But the same time that that happened, my wife went into a horrible depression and ended up back in Peachford, which I'm telling her story, but that was like cold water in my face. And, you know, I come from a family of depressives, and, you know, the book says this right here. It's interesting. People say, well, what step is she on? And I'm like, what the hell step does someone who's freaking catatonic work? My wife's in the bed in the fetal position. What would you have her do? Write an inventory? I mean, really? I mean, she went into freaking depression as a damn illness. What do you tell somebody in the program? Oh, you've got, you've got diabetes. Work the third step. Let's see how that works for you. But anyhow, and this is one of my favorite lines, but this does not mean that we disregard human health measures. God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such people. I mean, I've heard some crazy shit. Excuse my language, but when somebody who, let's see, and what is your degree in? Oh, I saw it hanging on the wall under the bridge you're sleeping under. You're giving out medical advice to someone who's depressed or has some sort of issue. Obviously, you know, that if you have some type of mental illness, you take your medication to put you on the damn playing field so you can work your steps. And that's what, you know, and we were, again, I don't want to be so nasty the people we got that advice from, because this was 1990, and, you know, the field has broadened. But thank God my wife and I went through some pretty intensive therapy and counseling. And, you know, my great-grandfather shot himself at 72. Two of my first cousins have died recently, drug overdoses, depression. I mean, it runs in my genetic code just like freaking blue eyes and, you know, and crazy behavior. But so, you know, we, out of that kind of going down here, my wife and I got help from outside sources and have moved forward. You know, that was 1990. And, I mean, sobriety, it's been good. I hate to say sobriety's been good. I have a car, a house, a marriage. I have grand. Hell, that might not be your story. I didn't come to AA to get a freaking nice resume. I mean, or to get a house in Buckhead or a BMW. Hell, I don't care if I drive a BMW or a freaking, as long as the thing runs. I came to AA to be sane, to just be able to live a normal life. we're pretty well off, man. I own a business. I coach football. But that doesn't mean anything. You could take that crap from me, and I could live in a single wide trailer as long as I get to go to AA and coach football. Now, you know, I'll be all right. I mean, I don't care. I just wanted to live one day at a time where I didn't have that freaking, you know, the book talks about that. Just that obsession that would never lift. Every day I woke up, it was alcohol or drugs, and I had no way to get out from under it. And if, you know, someone that's not an alcoholic doesn't get it. I mean, I tell people at church, and you'll tell people about my history, and they'll look at me like, are you kidding? I mean, like you're from another planet. I talk to you guys, you're like, oh, hell yeah, I did that 40 times, man. You know, get hit with a bat, you know, get up, roll around in my puke, fight cops, drive cars into, you know. Y'all are like, ha, oh, that's a great story. Other people are like, my God. Oh, you poor thing. I said, hell, poor thing, we had a blast. We got up and did it the next night. But anyhow, you know, that's, but I will, I mean, again, I can't, you know, my life is good. I mean, I went from stealing money out of the plate at church to actually being a member of the church. I actually am an usher. They let me take the money up now. I mean, my buddy and I used to say, oh, let's, you know, we're going to get 20 today, buddy. You know, he's because they're, anyhow, I went from being a thief and a kid, what do you call them, the dead end kids with no future. And Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And, I'll leave you with, it's amazing how God uses you. Like I said, I think my biggest regret from drinking was that I didn't get to continue to play athletics. I mean, I wasn't that good. I was an average Joe, but I loved it. And what the program has done is it allowed me to start coaching football that 14 years ago. And I've just been able to be involved with all these kids. But it was interesting. There was this kid I coached who played. He went up to Detroit and he got cut by the Lions. He played at Wake Forest. Then he went to Canada. And he got injured and all this. But he called me at the house one night and he said, Coach, I just want to ask you, I think I'm going to retire at, 24. But he said, I think I'm going to quit playing football. And I said, well, Chris, I think the fact that you are even saying you want to quit means you're done. And he said, because, to play football, you have to be 100% committed. There's not any either. But anyhow, what was interesting is when we finished the conversation, and I said, well, Chris, I appreciate the fact that you called your old coach, for some wisdom. He said, I didn't call you because you're my coach. He said, I called you because I respect you as a man and how you've poured into my life. He said, this isn't about football. And I was like, wow. And I remember it brought tears to my eyes because I was thinking, this kid called me because he actually thought that I had something to share with him. And because I had poured, God had allowed me to be in a position to pour into his life. These kids, they call me. And God has taken me, who was really a beaten down. And I think about that coach telling me, you're poison. You'll pretty much never amount to anything. And how God has taken me, a broken down, drug addicted, alcoholic teenager, and has used me in ways that I can never envision. And that's the last thing I'll leave you with. If I would have written a list down of what I wanted when I came in this program, I would have sold myself short, because God has given me a life through Alcoholics Anonymous that I could have never imagined and never dreamed of. And I appreciate y'all listening to my story tonight. Thank you.